Welcome to this episode of Fossils and Fiction, a podcast that explores the stories of prehistoric life, most often through the stories we humans tell about it. It's produced by me, Travis Holland, with support from Charles Sturt University. Enjoy. Have you ever had a conversation that felt like it could go on for hours and you'd be just as entertained and enthralled in the last minutes as you were in the first? I've interviewed a lot of people over the years, but my guest on this episode offered, without a doubt, my funniest and funnest ever interview. Jimmy Waldron is the founder of a non-profit called Dinosaurs Will Always Be Awesome. He took that simple idea and made it great. Here's my chat with Jimmy. Today on Fossils and Fiction, I'm chatting with Jimmy Waldron from Dinosaurs Will Always Be Awesome. He's got a little bit of a Jack Black thing going on there. Hi,
You're
Jimmy.
You're not the third person who said that.
Hey, I take that fully as a compliment. I would love to be compared to Jack Black.
No, absolutely. Travis, thank you so much for having me here. Actually, I've gotten the Jack Black comment before. And the one that I don't stop talking about is I was a guest on Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend. And so I got a chance to talk to him about Therizinosaurus and the best dinosaurs in the world. And at the end of it, he said, "You got a real Jack Black thing going about you." So I was like, okay, yeah. Well, that's, I'll wear that forever.
That's my from someone who's partners. Actually met Jack.
Jack's inner circle. It was funny because I had the Jack Black conversation when I was talking about dinosaurs. And then about a week or two after that, Jack Black did a video as a dinosaur going to the UN to talk about how we have to be better about taking care of our planet. So I was like, full circle. He has to know.
Yeah. We'll tag him in the posts. Jimmy, we're actually here not to talk about Jack Black, but to talk about your nonprofit, Dinosaurs Will Always Be Awesome. I love that you've taken a phrase that is just rings true to so many people. And you said, "I'm going to name an organization this." How did you come to that point?
So the origin story behind this was that it was originally going to be a different kind of podcast that I was doing with my friend Dean Lomax. So Dr. Mm-hmm. Dean Lomax is one of the world's leading experts on ichthyosaurs and has been a friend of mine for decades now. And one of the things that we always wanted to do was we wanted to get a chance to take paleontology and make it exciting for working adults. So much dinosaur stuff for kids. But for grown-ups who want to step back into the sandbox and learn more about what's going on, they need something too. So we came up with this idea. We were going to call it Meso 52. Because it was 52 weeks of the Mesozoic era. And I came up with a cool mm-hmm. little logo, and I showed it to somebody, and she said, what's with the leaf? It's not a leaf. It's a three-toed theropod footprint. It looks like a leaf. And this doesn't make sense. What are you talking about? And he said, it's about animals. It's about prehistoric. I don't get that. What do you want people to know? What I really want people to know after all this is that no matter what you do, where you're from, or how old you are, dinosaurs will always be awesome. Just, well, that's your show.
Yeah.
So yeah. In that moment, the title was born. It's a statement, it's a fact, and now it's a nonprofit organization.
Yeah. So you started off with a podcast then. And I know it's been on a little bit of a hiatus there, but you're thinking about bringing it back. What's the progress there for the podcast?
Yeah, so we had a few years of good shows. Dean was able to co-host with me for a few episodes that were really strong in the beginning, and it kind of branched out. And I would use this as a platform to connect with scientists and researchers and people who are in the field of dinosaurs to try and get them to talk about their work and how wonderful things are. It's being retooled. So we've taken some time. I've gone on a few different adventures. I've gone out to different museums. I've done some traveling around the world to actually visit some of these great museums and record some new things. So there's a lot of content that's being built up. And now it's just a matter of finding time to actually produce videos to connect, not only through YouTube and Instagram and things like that. But the biggest change, and perhaps the most important change of this, is that the vision of Guava has changed as well. Because the idea of being able to sit and talk to someone and connect with them through a podcast is something that, you know, it's getting pretty common now. There's a lot of great podcasts that are out there. You've got I Know Dino, you've got Adele, who you met with, the Pals in Paleo. Mm-hmm. And there's so many different great platforms. The Skeleton Crew I've met half those people. I know a lot of the folks in the Skeleton Crew. And so the line of engaging people with science is one that's getting beautifully filled up and wonderfully comfortable. But over the course of my travels and my background, I think I found out that there are so many communities that don't have the hands-on experience that comes along with this. So I was finding out that our podcast metrics were showing that we were being around the world, very popular in places like Ukraine, Canada, Japan, even had a lot of stuff being reposted in the Middle East and things like that, which was kind of cool because that's where Stan is now. And so the show was getting out there. And people I would talk to would say, this is so great. I love seeing things through the eyes that you're doing. And I wish I had a museum nearby where I could go see these things for real. I had a conversation, one of the episodes we filmed with Matthew Mossbrucker, who is the director of the Morrison Museum of Natural History in Morrison, Colorado. And in the course of our, he's a very cool guy to meet as well, by the way. He is 100% Ian Malcolm energy. he's so cool.
I know exactly what you mean when you say that. Yeah.
If you check him out or you check out the Morrison Museum's Instagram and you see the things they post, you see he's just a cool guy. He's one of the coolest people in the world. I said, what do you think needs to happen to improve museums? And what's the next chapter of museums? And he says, museums need to become decentralized. You should have a museum on every street corner so that people can get their hands on these specimens and see things for real. And I thought, well, that's a pretty cool idea. So what Dwaba has become now is the podcast is still going to be part of it. The YouTube channel is still going to be part of it. The bulk of what we're doing now is live, hands-on mobile museums. So I actually have a trailer I hook up to the back of my Jeep. I load a bunch of real and replica fossils, and I go out to libraries and schools, community centers. I go to these locations where there are people who are 50 miles away from a natural history museum. And that's an important statistic. That's the reason why. But I go out to these places where people don't have access to museums of their own, and I bring them one. Yeah. And so I do a customized presentation. We do something specific. If they're going over a particular lesson plan in school, I'll build all that and talk about dinosaurs for 20 minutes of it and go through the scope of it. And then there's 20 to 24 different activities that we do that are all hands-on and very intuitive. And then there are other great components that we bring in too, so that we can take a day and give people a wonderful experience in a museum. The reason I got into all this stuff, and I think it's one of your other questions for later on, when I was very young, when I was 4 years old, my mom used to bring me to the Museum of Natural History in New York City. And I would go up and I'd look at that still upright standing Tyrannosaurus Rex and just see this massive monster and think, wow, something like that used to live here and now it's just gone. And just, I had the ability to go and see this dinosaur in person and touch things with my bare hands and then be escorted out of the museum by security guards who said, don't touch that. But a lot of people don't have that same experience. And so I wanted to give, I don't want people to have the same experience that I did. I want them to have theirs.
I grew up in a really small town that was significantly further than that from any major museum or certainly any natural history museum. Yeah. It was a rare thing indeed to actually get to go to one of these museums. I think the first I went to, there's a blue whale hanging in the entry hall kind of thing. And it's a rare thing to actually get the opportunity to go to these museums for some people, some communities. And how do you make a notion that, I want to learn about science, I want to get involved in this world, if you never see it, if it's not part of your life in any way. So absolutely. Getting out on the street corners and going to the schools is really, really nice. So you have a bunch of puppets as well that you take, I've seen.
I don't know if she likes to be called a puppet. She's very friendly if you call her a puppet.
Well, that's a behind the scenes thing. It's, like saying, talking about Santa's true identity.
this is my good friend Poe. She is a life-size robot Deinonychus. And so she'll come out with me to a lot of these different presentations. And she has a wonderful time meeting people and really just getting to, there we go. But yeah, so Poe is a life-size Deinonychus. And so she comes out with me to a lot of the different presentations so that people can see what a real raptor-type dinosaur would have looked like. You know, they think about Blue and the Jurassic World and Jurassic Park versions, and they see these big, scaly reptilian villains. And when we talk about how, like, for example, I'll bring out this velociraptor foot. And so I can show people a life-size raptor foot. They can see the killer claw here, and they can see the grasping, the digits here, and then the splint claw in the back. And they can see the feet of this animal, very much like the feet of a bird. And then when I show them, well, we have animals like that today, like this cassowary foot, which, just like the raptor, has that one long, really nasty claw on the outside. It's the only dinosaur with a confirmed human kill count, by the way. So you want to talk about the scariest dinosaurs out there, the cassowary is actually taking people out.
it's magpie swooping season here at the moment, so I'm not so sure on that count.
Magpie swooping season.
Yeah, when they get into breeding season, they get very territorial, and anyone they perceive as a threat, very often cyclists, they will swoop down out of the trees and they'll follow you a good half kilometer or so as you're moving through their territory and start swooping from the trees, pecking at your face and head. Like, fantastic YouTube videos out there.
Yeah. No, that sounds like...
But the cassowary is awesome. Yeah. Chasing off the birds. But the cassowary is awesome. I've come face to face with a cassowary at a wildlife park up here, and they're just amazing birds, you know. So to make that comparison and say, look, this is a real animal that we have today that looks very much like what we see in the fossil record, how do people respond to that, particularly kids?
Well, the kids are on board with it. The kids jump on right away. They're like, oh, yeah, that's so awesome. This is amazing. I actually even have a cast of the Berlin Archaeopteryx. And so I'll show that and say, hey, look, here's the claws and the teeth of a dinosaur with the feathers of a bird. And kids are like, yeah, no, okay. Dino Dana covered the same thing last week. I'm with you.
But they know all about it.
They do. But it's the parents and the caregivers and the nannies and the teachers who will so often be taken aback, because when they're seeing this thing and they're seeing Poe covered all these feathers and they see the size of her compared to, when I tell them that this teal green color is the exact same shape, size, and color of a real life Deinonychus egg, the adults start going in all those different directions. Like, you see the math equations forming in front of their face. Like, how is that? How do you know that? How is that a thing? And so getting, because for adults, it's deconstructing things that they've been taught for 20 years. For kids, it's all new, or it's something that they are already ready to be on board with because dinosaurs are awesome and they love to learn about them. And so if you show something to a kid, they're like, okay, yeah, no, that checks out. That tracks. That's cool. But you show an adult, it's like, no, that's not what I saw in the Flintstones, okay? They wear collars and they go, that's what dinosaurs do. No. So it's really cool to have those kind of moments.
I was at a museum here in Canberra, and I was wandering around looking at some of the specimens, and there was a kid there with his mum, and he knew everything, this kid. He knew absolutely everything, and the mum just could not keep up. You know, she was really struggling to keep up, and at one point, the kid turned to me and he was just so enthusiastic, and he asked a question. I'm just sort of wandering along, looking at everything myself. And he asked me this question, and I said, yeah, you know, and I told him a few things that I knew. And the mum's like, oh man, she said, I just don't know any of this. I don't know where he gets it from. And I think that notion of bringing the knowledge and bringing the excitement to the parents actually is great, because then they can enable the kids to keep going, to go harder, to learn more. I really love that. So
thank you.
Yeah, how do you,
the first time I was published in a scientific journal, it was a study about teaching evolution to kindergarten and second grade. And the scope of the idea was that Now, the kids are going to catch on pretty quickly, but how do you approach the subject of evolution in a way that's not going to get the teachers to start ruffling and clutching pearls? So I built a lesson plan around Hesperornis, because mm-hmm. I had a specimen of a Hesperornis with me at the museum where I worked. I was able to bring out for this. And we built a lesson of design a bird. You've seen a bird. You know the parts of a bird. Tell me what a bird looks like. Okay, now draw on a piece of paper. Now show me what that bird would look like if it lived underwater or if it lived in a dense jungle. And these kids would take the same basic form of a bird and they would make adjustments to it. Like if it's going to live near water, then it doesn't need the big feathers. It's going to have like shorter feathers and it's going to position its body differently so it can swim. And so the basic concept, which is at the root of the understanding of evolution, which is life changes over time and animals adapt to circumstances in their environment in order to continue surviving. Those little nuggets caught on real fast with the kids, and they were able to see it and take it forward. And it was also presented to the teachers in such a way where they kind of had to look at it and say, oh, okay, I was misframing what I thought the E word really was. It's not a thing like I'm going to empty a big bucket of evolution on your desk. No, it's a process. And it's a way that we describe ways the way something changes over a time. I actually even had one presentation where I had a skeleton of a chicken and a skeleton of a T-Rex. And I was I had a table with very simple setup, just those two things. And I was at a raptor center. So it was a bird rehabilitation center. And I had a person who from across the courtyard looking at me goes, no. I do not believe that this turns into this. I'm like, okay, great. Because it would have to be over a long time. I'm like, yeah. And it wouldn't be all at once. I'm like, no, I agree with you. And then you just see her like realizing that she just talked herself into the basic understanding of what evolution is. And she's like,
yeah.
Okay, we're gonna talk more about this. She came by the museum the next day to have more conversation and kind of expand her worldview a little bit. So it's great when those connections start firing. It's wonderful.
Yeah. That's really cool. And we've started to touch on this then, but what, you know, how do you blend entertainment and facts? What are some of the strategies that you use to do that?
So one thing that really helped me is I've always been, I was always the funny kid. So I had a theatrical background growing up.
I can't
up,
tell at all.
Right? All of these have just been very dry, very droll. It's like,
turn your books to page 17. We're going to talk about the division between the Thyreophora, as we like to know them, ankylosaurs and stegosaurs.
Yeah, so like that kind of stuff doesn't work. But I did a lot of acting in high school and in college and things like that. And you know, I've always liked being able to tell a story, keep things fun and exciting. And so when I got into my role as a museum educator, a lot of banter had to happen. You know, I would do these huge, elaborate shows built around explosions, for example. I wrote shows where we would blow up balloons full of different chemical salts to produce the colors that you see in fireworks. And sometimes you'd have a big showstopper, and whatever reason, the balloon would just pop, and it wouldn't explode, or it just wouldn't go off at all. And so you gotta fill for time. So you
gotta vamp a little bit, yeah.
A little bit. You have to do that. So there has to be a blend of like improvisation. You know, like improv classes are really good to get, so you can learn how to build off of what's going on there and being able to just own up to the awkwardness and the strangeness of our situations. You know, the things that we're doing, you know, talking about these, you know, 11-foot-tall lizard birds that used to stomp across the Rocky Mountains when they were 2.5 feet tall, or these 50-foot-long Komodo dragons that swam across the oceans of Kansas. Like, there's a certain amount of incredulity to all this sort of stuff that you have to be able to kind of laugh about. And so if you take it too seriously, then people will shy away because it's not, they want to be hooked and entertained. They want to learn while they're enjoying things. So you have to have a blend of, you know, things that are interesting, things that are informative, and things that are ridiculous, because comedy comes in threes.
You mentioned Dino Dana, and I think Jurassic Park was hiding in the background there as the things that people learnt, you know, 30 years ago. Is there any other role for pop culture in what you do?
Any other role? What do you mean?
How do you use pop culture, or do you just, you know, people come to you with an idea in their head, and so you play with that a little bit, or what do you do with pop culture and those kinds of ideas that are floating around out there?
So we have there's a concept that we use in education called scaffolding, which mm-hmm. is where you build towards a difficult concept through digestible chunks of information that people can understand. You want your learners to be able to join you along the way, step by step. One of the things that helps people to feel comfortable is having a level of familiarity with it. And so if I say to someone that, Giraffa Titan is a long-necked sauropod whose forelimbs are longer than their hind legs, people are going to be like, okay, like I know what a giraffe is, but like, it's like a big giraffe. I say, no. But if I say, do you remember the scene in Jurassic Park when they first saw that Brachiosaurus? And you saw that massive long neck and it stood up and the music was rising and they're moving herds and stuff, right? The dinosaur that we called Brachiosaurus has been reclassified, got a new name of Giraffa Titan. And people are like, oh, that's a cool name too. So
yeah.
Is Jurassic Park required viewing? Yes, for most things, including getting your driver's license. But in these kind of conversations, making a connection to something that people are already familiar with helps them to say, hey, this is what we're talking about. Oh, you're already with me. Fantastic. I need you to help me get the other people on board too. And so having that connectivity means that when you're there, being the guide on the side instead of the sage on the stage, you say, hey, I want everyone to know this. You already know part of it? Great. You're on my side already. Let's get the rest. And so you use that pop culture influence to help people stay connected to the things that they already know. So between the regular 8 to 5 that I do throughout the day, and then I come home, and then my 5 to 9 is getting the museum here operational. Because Guava is listed not only as a 501c nonprofit, but it's also credited with the IRS as a natural history museum. And so the fossils, the bones, and the replicas, the thing that I have here, like this... the last this incredible Apatosaurus femur that's just hanging out in my room. Yeah. You don't see that every day, but here it is. So these kind of things, because of the nature of what they are and how they travel, like this is the thing that I'm most focused on now. So I spend a lot of my time when I'm not at the main job researching grants, trying to get future presentations set up, collaborating with other artists and other people in the dinosaur industry as it is to try and help grow things, and then all the tedious Instagram you gotta do nonstop. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, keeping up with those socials can be a bit of a struggle. How do you generate ideas then for new initiatives and new pieces of content to get people engaged? Content is the thing nowadays, right? Do you have a process there, or just suddenly lightning strikes?
Lightning tends to strike, and so a lot of times I'll see something that's going on in the world and say, hey, there's a way that we can make a connection to this. Or you look at some of the things that are trending in terms of, like, you know, we're all doing the Wes Anderson thing now. I did not jump on the Wes Anderson trend, but there are some things you can see. I will say this, though. A lot of times on my commute back and forth into work, when you get into that, like, that highway blindness kind of thing, I'll have voice memos going on my phone, and I'll make up some silly little song about something having to do with, I did a thing where I saw someone mention, oh, you like dinosaurs? Great. Name every one of them. And I'm like, okay. And then over the matter of about 20 minutes, I took Billy Joel's We Didn't Start the Fire, and I renamed it into the names of every single dinosaur, A through Z, with a few that are crossed over here. So, Those moments of what's happening in the world, what's exciting, what's weird, and then, you know, what kind of comes to me. And so, and then I put all those things down and I write them into a book, and then I never do anything with them.
That's one thing about when you're an ideas person, you come up with too many ideas to actually execute on sometimes. Mm-hmm. My mind, when you said, somebody said, can you name all the dinosaurs? My mind immediately went to taking Tom Lehrer's Elements song and doing that one with dinosaurs. So, but We Can't Start the Fire is probably Stop the Fire is probably more well known.
These are the only dinosaurs so far that can survive. Might be many more than they have been discovered.
Exactly right, and that line at the end there really sums up natural science.
It really does.
That's probably a really great place to end. Jimmy Waldron from Dinosaurs will always be awesome. Thank you so, so much. This has been a fantastic interview.
Travis, thank you so much for having me. This has been a blast and a half, and I'm just getting warmed up.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Fossils and Fiction. We're always looking for more paleo stories to tell and welcome your suggestions through our social channels. You can also send voice notes via Spotify or social media. Podcast theme music is Sonora by Quincas Morea via the YouTube Audio Library. Show notes are available on the website, fossilsfiction.co. Please subscribe and rate the podcast on your preferred podcasting platform.